Hi, I'm Lauren Gilger, co-host of the show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode.
Good morning. It's the show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, will big government Democrats rethink their stance now that they see what Trump is doing with that power?
And getting into the field of aerospace medicine in a city near sea level.
But first, despite our divisive times, Arizonans largely agree on many major issues. They want affordable housing, investment in childcare and post-secondary education. They like dual enrollment so students can earn high school and college credits at once. They're okay with investment in major transportation projects like freeways and public transit. The Center for the Future of Arizona has polled on this for decades, and the findings are consistent. Even Republicans and Democrats agree on this stuff. But now the think tank is taking that consensus one step farther, putting real numbers behind these priorities. What would it look like if Arizona actually invested in them? And what does Arizona stand to gain? Economist Jim Rounds of Rounds Consulting Group carried out the analysis. And while the results are striking, think upwards of $13 billion in economic gains. Rounds is here now to tell us more. Thanks for coming in, Jim.
Oh, thanks for having me.
All right. So how did this come about, first of all, this collaboration?
So I've always admired what CFA has done, and I was in a meeting that had nothing to do with any of these topics, really. Dr. Francis and I just started talking, and I said, have you ever thought about monetizing some of the things that the voters want? And we just started talking from there, and we came up with this idea. And I really like the way that it's moving. Like I've talked to you all before in different interviews where I always said we need more calculators down at the Capitol. We need to do these types of analyses of items so that we can decide, is it going to cost us more than we're going to get in return? Because we have limited resources, and it's going to be even more so the next couple of years.
Yeah. Okay. So let's talk big picture, first of all. The findings here are pretty massive, $13.6 billion in economic gains across these categories. Did this surprise you?
The numbers didn't surprise me as much as in the past, I've always been skeptical of how much voters really understood. Mm-hmm. You know, they're making decisions about voter initiatives, and usually it whoever has the best sign or the tagline ends up winning. And I thought, well, we actually need experts. We need lawmakers. We need the voters to delegate to people that can become more knowledgeable. But this showed me that voters actually know what they're talking about on a lot of the important pieces. Mm-hmm. And the economic findings were very strong in the same areas where the voter preferences were very strong. So that was surprising, and it opened my eyes to the fact that maybe we have to trust what the voters want and that these types of surveys are valuable as long as we can add the little bit of math on the end.
Okay, so let's get into that math a little bit and some of the specifics here, starting with child care. I mean, everyone knows this is a big issue. Families are grappling constantly with how to pay for it. The average cost, you say, is $1,200 or so a month for a family in child care. We're facing, at the same time, a big shortage of child care workers. 70% of voters, CFA has found, agree that, you know, we should fix this. This is a priority. But what would that look like? Like, how much would it cost the state to invest in something like childcare?
Well, that's the question. And so when you do a return on investment, you first have to figure out what the economic gains are.
Mm-hmm.
And then once you identify that, you identify what can we do to get to that point so that it meets the assumptions. And our assumption was that we'd get rid of the imbalance in supply and demand, and we'd have enough access to childcare that is reasonably affordable. Prices keep going up. And we found that if we could have everybody having access to childcare that's looking for childcare, I think the average household was saving around $800 a month or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just with childcare. And that goes into other economic development issues too, because we need parents that want to work to have access to childcare so that they're working and then they're paying taxes and paying more money into the things that we need to invest in other areas of government. So it goes back and forth. So you kind of have this dynamic benefit that can grow rapidly if we can come up with some efficient ways of implementing it.
So you can decide how much you want to invest based on how much you want to get back, essentially.
But you have to make sure that if you want to invest a small amount, Yeah, but you know that it's going to have a positive ROI of 2 to 1. If you invest $20 million, you're going to get double that back within a certain period of time. That's part of the analysis. But it in a lot of cases, it just has to be 1 to 1 or better for the things to break even fiscally. But those aren't the real popular projects. The popular ones are when we go in and say there's a 5 to 1 return within 3 years. You're helping foster kids. We're working on childcare, and we're working on another item as part of this socioeconomic development package that's being put together by some clients or some friends or us just working as a think tank. Mm. So it's fun to do this because we're getting better services, but we're not charging the public as much. I mean, who can argue against that?
Yeah. And with childcare in particular, there's these kind of long-term ripple effects, right? Like early childhood education leads to big payoffs down the road for like the next generation. So way down the road.
Yeah. Well, the tightest doing different regression analyses in the past, this is where I, nerd out a little bit. The tightest correlation between academic performance and another variable is household income.
Mm-hmm.
And when we have households that are better off, they're able to invest in things like healthcare. They're able to invest in other items that also lift academic achievement. So it started off being an analysis of 5 separate items, but it was one of those Venn diagrams where the circles overlapped, not just like the Olympic circles where it overlaps one at a time. All these circles were coming together, which I think is how we've always described the economy, that a lot of things interrelate and we have to work on everything, but we have to also understand that there's costs and we have to do it efficiently.
That's really interesting. I want to talk about affordable housing as well. This is one it seems like everyone can agree there's a major problem, but no one can really agree on how to solve it. What approach did you take in this analysis in terms of how to even tackle this issue?
Well, in this particular one, and again, these are just starting points in the discussion, we wanted to find out what would happen if everybody was able to pay the income constrained individuals were able to pay 30%. Because as income goes down, it doesn't just go up to 35, it goes into the 40s for the lower income households. And so the policy, you have to have different policies for different income groups. But overall, we had household saving about $8,000 a year.
Wow.
We would create about 100,000 new jobs across the state and about $600 million in state and local tax revenues. So you get back to that ROI.
Mm-hmm.
Can we spend $600 million? $300 million would be the state roughly. Can we spend $300 million at the state level and create that many new housing units so we can get down to a more affordable level? And I would say yes. I mean, we have ideas on how to do it with no taxpayer costs, and I'm hoping that the legislature will listen to some of those, but that's a topic for another show.
Well, last question for you in the last 30 seconds here is the rubber hit the road question, right? Like, in terms of taking these kinds of priorities, this return on investment, which can be very impactful, how do you get this across to lawmakers? Where do you want to see this implemented?
They're already responding. We started the ROI analyses on some healthcare projects in the past, then on university investment, and now we do it on most of our own fiscal analyses. The mm-hmm. state will issue theirs. Ours includes, dynamic impacts. But the idea is to use this more universally on all the major projects that could have a dramatic impact on the state. Because it's not necessarily the topic, like it's good or bad.
Yeah.
It's are you implementing it properly or are you not in a lot of cases? So again, more math the better.
All right, we'll leave it there. Economist Jim Rounds of Rounds Consulting, thank you.
Thank you.
As the Trump administration continues its mass deportation campaign across the country, more pregnant immigrants are being detained. Under the Biden administration, there was guidance that ICE shouldn't detain pregnant or postpartum people, but Trump rescinded a similar Customs and Border Protection policy earlier this year. Now, more pregnant women are being held in detention facilities across the country, and we're seeing lawsuits being filed over that. One from a woman who miscarried in custody, another who went into labor days after being released. And our next guest treats some of the people being held in immigration detention, and she says it's no place for a pregnant person. Amanda Heffernan is a certified nurse midwife and assistant professor at Seattle University who works at a federally qualified health center that mainly serves migrants and refugees. She does prenatal care, women's health care, postpartum care, and attends births in the hospital. Before moving to Washington, she did this work in Tucson, where, as she told The Cut recently, she sometimes would see Border Patrol agents waiting outside of hospital rooms, guarding the patients inside. Here's our conversation.
We're certainly getting indications that more pregnant people are getting detained. It's really difficult to track, and there's not a lot of transparency or data available, so it's hard to have any numbers. But for instance, in the last few months, there have been four women, pregnant women that we know of detained at the Northwest Detention Center in Tacoma, Washington. Mm-hmm. That's just one detention center among many. And I think also there's a chance that we could have missed people. There's 120 women on the unit where we've been made aware of these four pregnant women over the last few months. Mm-hmm. ICE isn't obligated to let anyone know if they're detaining a pregnant woman. So it's by word of mouth.
Okay, so you're made aware of these women in detention near you there in Washington, and then you try to work with them. What kind of care are they receiving?
Yeah, it's very fragmented. So there are medical units within the detention centers where people are able to see a provider. It can be hard to get an appointment there. There's a lot of stories of people who, you know, maybe wait in line all day and then don't get seen, or alert guards to symptoms they're having. It takes quite a while to be seen. But the thing of note for pregnant people is that those providers are not obstetric providers. It's not a prenatal exam, and there's not an assessment of the well-being of the fetus or an ultrasound or anything like that. Hmm. So that to happen, people have to be taken off-site. It's very inconsistent. I've spoken to people who were detained for months and were never taken off-site for a prenatal visit at all.
Hmm. So what are some of your concerns? Like, what are you seeing in the people that you're working with right now?
Well, one of the things that sometimes folks aren't as aware of if you're not in this field is that prenatal care has a rhythm to it. Things are supposed to happen at certain weeks of gestation in the pregnancy. You know, you're supposed to be seen once a month at the beginning of the pregnancy, every 2 weeks in the middle, and every week towards the end, with labs and ultrasounds done at certain weeks of gestation. Yeah. And so when people are taken for outside visits, either very haphazardly or not at all, things are missed. And I've also seen several folks who have quite high risk pregnancies who would need additional care or more frequent care than that, perhaps more frequent ultrasounds or different labs, and they're not getting what they need.
Hmm. So what used to happen, like prior to the Trump administration's deportation policy, was it the case that pregnant people would be allowed to be held in detention, or would they often be picked up by ICE and then, you know, bonded out, something like that?
Yeah, that's a great question. So towards the end of his second term, President Obama instituted a policy which essentially said that, with few exceptions, pregnant women shouldn't be detained by ICE. That policy was maintained through the first year of the first Trump administration, and then it was rescinded. So in 2018 and 2019, we saw a big uptick in the number of pregnant women detained. But as you noted, they usually had a fairly low bond. And so it seemed that ICE would try to deport them if they could, but wasn't interested in holding them for super long periods of time, and certainly didn't want to detain people in their third trimester or people that were imminently going to give birth.
Then, like, they didn't want to deal with the fact that this person might give birth in a detention center, right?
Exactly, yeah. Exactly.
So, Amanda, so you're working with these people who are being held, who are in the midst of a pregnancy. I guess the main question here is detention a safe place for someone who's pregnant? And there's a difference here, we should say, between a detention facility, which is often supposed to be kind of short term, and someone who is, say, in prison.
Absolutely. All of a sudden, with second Trump administration, we're seeing a lot more pregnant women detained in ICE facilities, which, you're absolutely right, are designed for shorter term detention. They're not designed to hold people having, you know, 10-year prison sentences. And I think that's part of the reason why they're not equipped to provide something like prenatal care. So, no, I don't think that it's a safe or healthy place for any pregnant person. The food is not of good quality. It's extremely stressful. You know, people who've experienced both the criminal carceral system and immigration detention sometimes say that the criminal carceral system is better. And mm-hmm. part of the reason is that they knew how long their sentence was going to be, and they at least had something to wrap their heads around.
You've talked about one person you're working with who was told that she might be carrying twins right before she was detained, but has no information, no follow-up on whether or not that's the case, that could put you into a high-risk category in a pregnancy, right?
Absolutely. Yes. And I met someone else who had had a history of preeclampsia in previous pregnancies and previous cesarean sections. So yeah, neither of those women was treated by ICE as if they had a high-risk pregnancy.
What is this like for these women that you're working with right now? Like, not just physically, like whether or not they're, you know, going through the kind of agreed upon protocol of medical care, but how are they handling this emotionally?
Yeah, it's profoundly stressful. Women often talk about feeling depressed and scared. Some of them are separated from their older children. Some of them are already mothers, and that family separation is really difficult. And the friends or family that are caring for their children don't always feel comfortable coming to a detention facility to bring the children to visit. So yeah, it's profoundly stressful and distressing.
Let me ask you, Amanda, like, what would you say to someone who says, you know, they kind of put themselves in this position, they should have followed the law, they should have done this the right way. And there's sort of this overarching, I'm sure, narrative here about if you're pregnant and you're not here with papers or you came here illegally or whatever it may be, you know, you're just hoping for citizenship for your unborn child. And lots of debate about that right now with the president's action on birthright citizenship. Like, looking at that political context, do you think that lots of people would say, fair enough? Or do you think this is a line that maybe hasn't been crossed before that is being crossed now?
I mean, I think I would ask people to be human and take a compassionate approach and recognize that, I mean, there's actually some pretty good research that shows that people don't migrate with the intention of having children in the U.S. so that they become citizens. You know, most of the folks that I've spoken with who were pregnant in detention were asylum seekers, mm-hmm. who fled their countries of origin under great duress and often fear for their lives. I heard a webinar last week with some folks from Raices, and Faisal El-Jabouri from Raices said something that really stuck with me. He said that when you see things like family detention, you know, detention of small children, detention of pregnant women, that it's a testing ground. It's like the Trump administration seeing how far can we go before people push back.
That's
and
really
so I think it's time to push back.
All right, we'll leave it there. Amanda Heffernan, a certified nurse midwife, as well as assistant professor at Seattle University, joining us to talk about her experience with pregnant women held at ICE detention. Amanda, thank you very much for coming on the show. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, as anxiety and depression rates rise among young girls, how can parents help them gain a stronger sense of self?
For girls, there is a pretty clear narrative about being nice, being accommodating, being peacemakers, getting along, succeeding. I mean, there's pressure on girls that, you know, now that they can be anything, they then have to be everything.
We'll hear from the author of a new book on the subject.
But first, when Dr. Jan Stepanek, who grew up in Switzerland, was in the military there, he served in the mountain infantry. That means he did a lot of hikes and marches at elevation. During those times, he says he saw plenty of people who didn't feel well being up that high. So when he came to the U.S. to train in internal medicine, a colleague and future mentor asked if he would be interested in training in aerospace medicine, a specialty he didn't know anything about at the time. Stepanek is now an internal medicine and aerospace medicine specialist at Mayo Clinic here in Arizona. He says he gets some strange looks from people when they find out he sees patients dealing with altitude issues in a practice that sits just about 1,000 feet above sea level. But he says his field isn't just about healthy people climbing mountains. It's also about common health conditions that can be made worse at altitude. I spoke with Stepanek recently, and we started with what exactly aerospace medicine is.
So aerospace medicine is a specialty that deals with the human body in extreme environments, you know, be that at extreme altitude, under G-forces, flight in space. And that sort of dovetails nicely because there's an overlap between those two specialties, especially in a place like Arizona, where we all, you know, live in the lower deserts, or most of us. But if it turns out that we want to escape the unrelenting, broiling oven called Phoenix, We dash up to the high country, and before you know it, you're at elevations of 8 to 10,000 feet, and with that, subject to some of the influences of high altitude.
Yeah, so what does it do to us? I mean, I think anybody who's driven, for example, from Phoenix to Flagstaff has felt their ears pop along I-17 along the way, but what does going from this low altitude in Phoenix to the high altitude of Flagstaff in a relatively short amount of time, what kind of impact does that have on our bodies?
So, you know, there's two versions of events. One is normal adaptation. So, you know, if we happen to live at low elevation and drive to altitude, our bodies are going to start to compensate for that change in barometric pressure. So if we go from sea level to 8,000 feet, there is about 25% less ambient pressure, which means less availability of pressure for gas exchange to occur. So our bodies start to compensate by breathing to excess. And as a result of that, you know, improving our oxygen levels at the expense of carbon dioxide, which, you know, when we go to altitude, that begets some, you know, not infrequent sense of dizziness, yeah, you know, a little bit of lightheadedness, a little bit of shortness of breath. For some people who are sensitive, maybe headache, maybe not sleeping as well. But that sort of adapts and people feel well thereafter, you know, after about a couple of days at the very most, if they're not acclimatized. You know, the symptom that you alluded to with the popping of the ears, that is just good old-fashioned volume changes, because as there is decreased barometric pressure and you have any sort of trapped gas, such as in your middle ear, if you don't equilibrate pressure well or your ears are stuffed up because you have a cold, that gas expands as we go to altitude, and that makes for the ear pop on I-17.
Are there more, I guess for lack of a better word, permanent changes or permanent impacts that we can see if we are sort of boomeranging between high and low altitudes in a short amount of time?
So it's not that there would be necessarily permanent changes for someone who goes, you know, on the weekend up to the high country to recreate, camp, or enjoy themselves. But there is adaptations that occur, you know, the higher you live, your body is going to start to not just increase the breathing and sort of adjust the acid base level in order to suit you better and serve you better and function better at altitude. But it's also going to start to increase your oxygen levels. And as a result of that, you know, increase your oxygen carrying capacity. So you're going to be better off at altitude when you're there for an extended period of time. But that takes weeks to months to actually occur. So for the weekend warrior, there's really not much in the way of anything permanent, you know, assuming that people are healthy, that would arise.
You kind of alluded to this, but I want to ask you more specifically. Are there people who are maybe more prone to altitude sickness, or maybe not feeling as well, or their body doesn't adapt as well to changes in altitude than others?
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, this is really what I do on a daily basis. You know, but what we talked about to date is really normal adaptation, which normal bodies, how they adjust, and then we start feeling well. Now, there's conditions where you may not be able to do so because of underlying conditions that preclude that adaptation. You know, very common, you know, would be issues where if you have reduced oxygen carrying capacity, so if someone has anemia, you know, that is not going to make for a fun trip to Flagstaff, because you're going to be breathing much, much more, and it's going to be much more taxing. People who have sleep disorder breathing. So if someone has, for instance, sleep apnea, you know, then they're going to have a very hard time adapting. And very importantly, also individuals who have right to left shunts. So conditions whereby spent blood is shunted from the spent blood side to the fresh blood side. And that may be something that is not strikingly symptomatic at low elevation, but becomes much more so when you go to high altitude, because the pressures on the right side go up and the pressures on the left side go down when we're at altitude. And so that becomes much more of an issue, and individuals may become significantly symptomatic, short of breath, and, you know, have problems with lack of oxygen. The importance, you know, that I see is the making sure that healthcare providers have an awareness of the impact of altitude and a variety of health conditions, and the potential value of further investigating, you know, some of these, because it can lead to the discovery of actually very significant underlying health problems that people may not have been aware of, and that, you know, if properly diagnosed, can then long-term, you know, alter the trajectory of their health.
I wonder if Arizona is, I mean, it seems like the, sort of the perfect place to both study and practice this field of medicine, because there are such big elevation changes, you know, in reasonably short distances. Are there other places that, that are like this, that, you know, where it might be as interesting to study this field?
You know, you point out something that is good old-fashioned topography, and there is not that many places where people have, just by a car ride, easy access to going from 1,500 feet to 8,000 feet. You know, we have several million people here in the low deserts at our doorsteps. And, you know, if they want to get out of the heat, it's literally a 2-2.5 hour car drive, and you're at elevation 7,000 feet plus. There's not that many places in this country where that indeed is the case. And, you know, our high country is actually, compared to other locations, you know, in this country, be that on the Pacific side or elsewhere in the world, it's not that easily accessible. So you can find places where you can have high peaks in your backyard, but those high peaks are not accessible by car drive.
All right. That is Dr. Jan Stepanek, internal medicine and aerospace medicine specialist at Mayo Clinic. Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. Over the weekend, we saw millions of people take to the streets and communities all over the country to protest the Trump administration. The No Kings demonstrations drew an estimated 7 million people at thousands of events nationwide, with people speaking out against the administration's immigration actions, slashing of federal funding, educational and environmental protections, and more. The events were organized by a network of progressive organizations that accuse the president of behaving more like a king than an elected president. But as progressives are watching what President Trump is doing with the powers of a big national government, our next guest wonders, will it make those traditional big government Democrats rethink their commitment to it? Bob Robb is a former longtime columnist for the Arizona Republic. Today, he writes a Substack. Rob is a small government conservative, so to him, the answer here is less than hopeful. I spoke with him more about it.
Small government conservatives have always believed that if you have an accumulation of power at the national level, and you concentrate that power in the president, you are likely one day to get someone who will misuse and abuse that power, which Donald Trump is doing on almost a daily basis. Liberals, on the other hand, have tended to support that expanded role for the federal government and greater authority for the president vis-a-vis the Congress, so long as that power was used to advance liberal policy. So now that they have seen how that power can be used in ways that they oppose and are very worried about, I think it's an interesting question. Will there be some kind of movement on the left to sort of try to reinforce the guide rails that the founders tried to create? The founders tried to create a structure of government in which no one would have the power that Donald Trump is now exercising so arbitrarily and capriciously.
This is what you mean when you say to a small government conservative like you, Trump was almost inevitable.
Yes, the assumption is that if you concentrate power, you won't always have, as our founder said, angels running the government, that you will have people that will try to use that power for personal advancement or to suppress opposing points of view or further aggrandize power and exercise it on a personal basis. So for a small government conservative, this is sort of one of the likely consequences of creating a federal government that's much more extensively involved in American society than originally intended, and concentrating the power of that federal government in a single individual.
Are you surprised this is coming from the right and not the left?
Not really. I mean, if the liberals wanted to use a bigger federal government and greater presidential authority to achieve liberal policy objectives, there really aren't conservative policy objectives that kind of power can be used for.
Mm-hmm.
So while I think it's probably highly likely, if not inevitable, that if you concentrate this power, it will ultimately be misused and abused, I think it's also reasonable to expect that is more likely to occur on the right than the left, because there's less legitimate purposes for using that kind of power from the right. And you're seeing that in Trump's arbitrary march through all these constitutional guardrails. They aren't really to achieve much in the way of policy objectives outside of immigration and tariffs. They're instead an exercise in raw political power.
So what do you think the answer is? Like, you pose this question that Democrats should maybe think about big national government and what that means in light of what they've seen Trump do. But do you think they will rethink that?
I think it's generally highly unlikely that they will want to return to sort of the separation of responsibilities between the national government and state and local governments and rebalance that. But there does appear to be on the left a renewed appreciation for the importance of separation of powers and checks and balances. You've seen two attempts by Democrats in the Senate to create some kind of restrictions on the president's tariff authority and his ability to simply shoot boats out of the water based upon the assertion that they are carrying drugs headed for the United States. You had a very small number of Republicans willing to support those efforts. And so right now we're still in the historical position where the members of Congress only support the separation of powers when someone from the other party is in the presidency. But at least you have Democrats starting to make this an effort at the congressional level. And you do have some ferment within intellectual circles on the left about trying to restore some of these guardrails against the exercise of arbitrary power.
You offer a really interesting example in the piece about Barack Obama early in his presidency saying that he didn't have the authority in the Constitution to give legal status to Dreamers, even though he thought they should have legal status. But then later on, he establishes the DACA program, right? Like deferred action for childhood arrivals, and does that. And now we're kind of watching similar or opposite things happen from the Trump administration. Is this sort of a self-fulfilling prophecy for the Democrats, you think?
Well, I do believe that if you create that kind of authority and you applaud doing things like Barack Obama saying that he's going to create a new immigration category, even though the Constitution clearly gives the authority over immigration to Congress, not to the president, you are likely to get a President Trump on the issue of tariffs, which the Constitution also clearly gives to the Congress, not the president, similarly trying to stretch whatever statutory authority might be misinterpreted to give one some kind of legal fig leaf for violating the division of responsibilities that are clearly set forth in the Constitution. Now, I will say, while there's Democratic precedent for all of this, Trump is pursuing a scorched earth approach to the exercise of presidential power, either given or assumed, unlike anyone in our previous history. So My hope, although not my expectation, is that the shock of that may create on the left a stronger or at least some degree of support for reducing the role of the federal government vis-a-vis state and local governments. Infrastructure is a great example of that. Mm-hmm. Trump is singling out infrastructure projects in Democratic polities. Well, if those were things that were done at the state and local level, he wouldn't have that lever to exercise. So I'm hoping, but not expecting, that seeing what can be done with that power may renew on the left some sense that, well, maybe that power ought not to exist. Maybe we should go back to the guardrails that the founders established that was intended to ensure that no one could exercise the kind of authority that Trump is currently exercising.
All right. Well, we'll wait and see. Bob Robb, former longtime Arizona Republic columnist and now Substacker, joining us to talk about his recent piece on this. Bob, thank you so much for coming on. I really appreciate it.
Always good to be with you.
Good morning. It is the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody. A number of studies have found rising rates of anxiety and depression among kids. And my next guest says those rates, along with those of suicide and eating disorders, are especially concerning among girls. Kate Rope is a journalist and mom to two girls. Her new book is called Strong as a Girl, Your Guide to Raising Girls Who Know, Stand Up For, and Take Care of Themselves. Rope says she hopes parents and caregivers of elementary school age girls will use it to help instill emotional intelligence and safety at a young age to stave off some of the negative potential outcomes. As part of her research, Rope spoke with middle and high school girls and asked them to reflect on their elementary school years, what was helpful for them becoming who they wanted to be, and what they wished was different. Rope joins me to talk about her new book and what she learned while writing it. And Kate, the title obviously kind of implies this, but what were you trying to get across to parents and caregivers here?
What I want to impart to them is the ability to actually see the girl in their lives that they're raising. You know, we have a lot of cultural messages out there about how things should go, whether that's about being a girl and being nice, or whether that's about, you know, taking a million extracurriculars so you get into the quote unquote right school. There's just a lot of pressure on parents and caregivers to produce a certain outcome with their kids. And what I'm attempting to do is help them step back and actually pay attention and see the person that's in their home and let her intuitive wonderfulness come through so that she ends up being able to be the person that she was meant to be, the person that she wants to be.
Do you find that for parents and caregivers, it's maybe harder to do that now than it has been in years past?
I think so. I don't know if it's harder. I think it's probably always been challenging and there's always been messages, but the pace of the messages and the directions they're coming from about, you know, there's just a lot of prescriptive talk that parents and caregivers are subjected to that makes you feel as if there's a right or wrong way to do things. And there isn't, because if there were, we would know that by now. There's a million ways to do it. And I think all the messages can get in the way of your own, as a caregiver, your own natural intuition about how to raise a kid, and then can get in the way of you seeing, you know, the innate parts of your girl that are so wonderful and that you want to make sure she maintains and develops and grows.
Are there particular challenges to trying to avoid putting girls sort of in a box, as you're describing, as opposed to letting them be who they are and sort of find their own path, as opposed to with boys?
Yeah, well, I'm not an expert on raising boys, having not done it, nor talked to all the experts about it. But I do know that for girls, and I'm sure boys have messages that come at them that narrow their scope of experience and expression. But for girls, there is a pretty clear narrative about being nice, being accommodating, being peacemakers, getting along, succeeding. I mean, there's pressure on girls that, you know, now that they can be anything, they then have to be everything. They're just under the microscope in a lot of ways. And I think that inhibits their natural, messy, expressive development that will help them, you know, find a path that feels true to them. And I do think that all of the messages parents and caregivers are getting and the messages girls are getting are just exponentially increased by, you know, a 24-hour news cycle, social media, all the different ways we're receiving information and advice and all the talking heads out there giving it. It's just kind of a constant barrage of shoulds.
Well, so I want to ask you about that, especially the social media and YouTube and everything online, because it's hard sometimes, I think, for parents even to break through everything that their kids are hearing, be it from social media, be it from the internet, be it from other friends at school or from wherever, or just everything else that they're hearing. So how do you advise parents to maybe in some ways allow their daughters to be who they are and not feel the pressure to conform to something that they don't really want to conform to, but that they feel pressure to?
Yeah. Okay. That's exactly it. The first thing is your home is a sanctuary of a safe place where they can express themselves and when they can experiment and they don't feel the watchful eyes on them. And at the same time, you instill in them critical thinking skills about all the other influences over which you have little control. You have some control, but in general, the world is going to interact with your child. And so if you can help her become a skeptic and someone who's going to ask questions before taking on gospel. So I think it's instilling critical thinking, and it's also really valuing their opinions all along from age 2 to, you know, 22, so that they know that what they think and what they express matters. And there will be times when you can't, they're going to be influenced. Adolescence is a time when they are supposed to be figuring out how to fit in with the herd, if you will. And so that will happen. But if they've got a really strong base and sense of who they are and sense of questioning everything that's being presented to them, then I think they have a stronger place from which to navigate all the messages and find a path that through them that feels good to them.
Well, so what are some of the signs and signals that you think parents and caregivers should be looking out for as girls of that age, of elementary school age, are maybe trying to signal something in ways that they can't quite verbalize?
Yeah. So I think, you know, honestly, this is it's not rocket science. The most important thing is just to listen more than you talk, to pause and to ask questions. I think there, as parents and caregivers, we feel a pressure to have the answers, but actually not having the answers gives them the space to explore the answers themselves. And in the book, I have very specific activities that are tied to different ages to help them get in touch with who am I, you know? Am I funny? Do I like to talk in a crowd? Do I take a while to, you know, feel comfortable? And then knowing that about myself, okay, what are my goals?
I'm curious about the focus groups that you did with the girls for this book. Were there any themes that emerged or any sort of trends that you heard over and over again, themes that you heard over and over again from these kids?
Yeah. I mean, the first thing I want to say is that was the best part about writing the book. And I would say the biggest thing that they were looking for in their childhood, in their younger years, that they either got and were grateful to have gotten or wish they had had was just transparency from parents, whether we're talking about puberty, whether we're talking about the state of the world. They wanted to be treated with respect and they wanted information to be shared with them. And I remember one young woman in particular, Adesoye, talked about how as a young girl, she really felt things deeply. She really got upset over big events or, in the news, things that felt unjust to her. And people would say, oh, don't worry about it. You're too young to worry about it. And she's like, but I did worry about it. I was thinking about it. And I wish that that had been respected and that people would have engaged me on the topic. So I would say for all of them, either the fact that they had families in which they felt it was safe to talk about anything and in which they felt their parents treated them with respect and talked with them openly about topics, or they didn't experience that. And that is something they would have liked because they felt it, even as like a 7-year-old or a 10-year-old, they felt when their family wasn't sort of giving it to them straight.
All right. That is Kate Rope, a journalist and author. Her latest book is called Strong as a Girl, Your Guide to Raising Girls Who Know, Stand Up For, and Take Care of Themselves. Kate, thanks so much for the conversation. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks so much. It was fun. Thanks, Mark.
All right, that's it for this edition of the show. We will, of course, be back with you again tomorrow for much more. And you can sign up for the show's weekly newsletter. It's called Radio Heads, and you can sign up at theshow.kjzz.org.
Don't forget also to follow us on Instagram. It is, as the kids say, a cool follow. I don't know.
Yeah.
Does anybody actually say that?
A good follow.
A good follow.
Solid follow. I don't know. Maybe a sick follow. How about that?
Oh, wow. Now we're definitely in uncharted territory for
getting
public
too
radio.
Cool for me. Yeah.
Anyway, on Instagram, we are at KJZZ The Show. The show is produced by Sativa Peterson, Nick Sanchez, Amber Victoria Singer, Athena Ankra, and Ayanna Hamilton, as well as Bruce Drummond. Sky Shout is our digital editor, Claire Lawton, our newsletter editor. Chad Snow is the news director. The show was created by John Hoban. Our executive producer is Amy Silverman. For Lauren Gilger and Sam Dingman, I'm Mark Brody here in Phoenix. Have a terrific rest of your day. Hope to have you right back here tomorrow.
That's it for this episode of the show's podcast. To find out more about the stories from today or other episodes, you can visit theshow.kjzz.org. And you can subscribe to KJZZ's The Show on your favorite podcasting site. I'm Lauren Gilger for Mark Brody. Thanks for listening today.